So it hit me sometime in 2008 when everyone was still buying new iPhones like they were oxygen tanks on the Titanic. I saw a guy standing in line for waiting for the newest model, talking loudly about his side hustle delivering digital marketing solutions or whatever, which, as far as anyone could tell, was mostly sending emails that no one read. And he eventually walked out with a gadget in one hand and a leased SUV waiting for him outside, acting like he had just survived a hurricane, when really, he was just surviving the latest iteration of debt. Now, to me, it looked like performance art. The middle class in full costume, pretending that the economy hadn't already died behind the scenes. And that's when it hit me. We were all just pretending. Pretending we were fine. We were stable. Pretending that if we kept the illusion going long enough, if we smiled and updated our LinkedIn bios, the economy would just graciously play along. But of course it didn't, because the middle class was never really stable. It was really just a rented illusion. It was a magic trick performed in suburbia with credit and debt and just an overall collective denial. Now, people talk about the disappearing middle class as if it's a tragedy. But I think the truth is, you can't lose what never really existed. Now, what do I mean by that? The middle class wasn't some natural stage of evolution. It was an economic mirage, a 30-year fluke that happened because the rest of the world was too busy being bombed to compete. So, after World War II, the US was the last man standing. Half the world was in varying states of ruin or struggling to survive. And on the other hand, the US had factories and oil and probably an unhealthy amount of optimism. It was the only time in history when capitalism actually looked somewhat fair, like the system was working for people, not on them. So the historian Tony Judt called this the golden age of capitalism, which is just historian speak for enjoy it while it lasts. So the government handed out GI bills, the unions were strong, wages went up, and a single income could buy a house and feed a family, and you could maybe even send your kids to college, assuming you didn't mind ignoring the racism and sexism and the fact that your furniture was made out of asbestos. So this was the era when your dad could fix the car himself, and your mom could stay at home without being judged. Basically, your neighbor could be a mailman and still own a boat. Imagine that. And people called this the American dream. But it was more like the American intermission. Because what they didn't tell you is that this little window of middle-class comfort wasn't the system working properly. It was the system on pause. It was a brief transition. And ultimately, it was a fluke born of global catastrophe and cheap oil. Now, the economist John Kenneth Galbraith wrote about this in his book, The Affluent Society, warning that prosperity itself was really just an illusion, and that the USA was just drunk on consumption and mistaking quantity for quality. But nobody listened, because when things are going well, no one wants to read the instructions on the bomb, right? And so the middle class became not just an economic category, but a moral one. It wasn't just about how much money you made. It was who you were supposed to be. Responsible, respectable, hardworking, dedicated. So ultimately, the human embodiment of a 30-year fixed mortgage. But here's the slap in the face reality. The middle class was never a permanent class. It was never supposed to be. It was just a transition zone. A waiting room between poverty and power that most people mistook for home. You weren't meant to stay there. And you were meant to spend your life trying to climb out of it and feel guilty if you didn't. I would say it was capitalism's cleverest trick. Creating a class of people stable enough to believe they weren't being exploited, but insecure enough to never stop working. So you could call it a kind of economic Stockholm syndrome. You start defending the system that's quietly strangling you because it gives you just enough comfort to believe you're free. So the sociologist C. Wright Mills once said that the middle class was politically tranquilized. I think he was being polite, because the truth is they were sedated on mortgages and sitcoms. The faint hope that their kids would do a little better. That was the deal. You work your whole life for stability, and then the economy changes the locks. And when you look around and realize the middle class is shrinking, everyone tells you it's your fault. You should have learned to code. You should have invested in crypto or been born in 1947. It's funny in a grim cosmic way that people still talk about saving the middle class like it's a species on the endangered list. But it's not the California condor. It's the dodo. It's gone. It's extinct. And what we're seeing now is just the taxidermy version. Neatly stuffed and displayed on political campaign stages. Now, politicians, you know, they love to promise to rebuild the middle class. But that's kind of like promising to rebuild the Roman Empire. Because you can't rebuild something that only existed because of a once-in-a-history set of global conditions. The post-war boom wasn't really progress. It was a lucky accident. And like all accidents, well, once you clean up the mess, things just go back to normal. And what's normal? Well, in the long arc of human history, it's basically some form of feudalism. A few people own everything, and everyone else just rents the illusion. The middle class wasn't the future, as Chris Hedges put it. It was the brief pause before the return of the past. All right. Now, if the post-war boom was the party, then the 1970s were the hangover. Oil prices spiked, wages flattened, and suddenly the average family realized the American dream came with an adjustable rate. And while the middle class was still humming along to disco, somewhere in some mahogany paneled boardroom, the wealthy had a meeting that basically went something like this. We've been too generous. It's time to take our money back. And that's not a conspiracy theory. That's just capitalism waking up from its post-war nap and remembering who's in charge. So, the economist, Milton Friedman, he published his famous declaration that the social responsibility of business is to increase its profits. Which sounds like something Satan would say if he'd gone to the University of Chicago. And in 1971, the corporate lawyer, Lewis Powell, wrote the now infamous Powell Memo, which some of you may be familiar with. It's basically a PowerPoint presentation for how the rich could get their dominance back. So the memo, it called for corporations to infiltrate media and education and obviously politics to make sure the next generation didn't get any wild ideas about fairness or unions or, you know, things like healthcare. And it worked beautifully. So by the 1980s, Ronald Reagan was smiling on TV while discreetly taking a chainsaw to the social contract. So unions were gutted, wages were frozen, and taxes on the rich, those were slashed. Now they called it trickle-down economics, which is just the plutocrats' polite way of saying you'll get wet eventually. It was the decade of deregulation and outsourcing And also, it was the time of mass migration of factories to anywhere that didn't have labor laws or OSHA inspectors. So the same jobs that built the middle class got shipped overseas, then were replaced by cubicles and motivational posters that said things like, teamwork makes the dream work. As if a slogan could somehow replace a pension. And it should come as no surprise that the result was a hollowed out economy propped up by image management. People were basically told to stop being workers and start being consumers. Because you might be broke, but at least you could buy stuff that looked like success. And this was the age of the shopping mall. Temples built to the gods of debt. Now, the rich realized they didn't have to raise your wages, as Chris Hedges wrote. They could just lend you money. And that's exactly what they did. Okay, well, then along comes the 1990s. The decade where the middle class didn't actually grow. It just leveraged. So in the 90s, the economy became a casino where everyone was betting on their own continued employment. Credit cards replaced raises. Home equity loans replaced savings. College debt replaced opportunity. And we didn't actually get richer. We just got better credit limits. So later on, the economist Thomas Piketty proved this mathematically. As productivity and corporate profits skyrocketed, wages flatlined. And where did all that wealth go? Well, straight up. And meanwhile, the rest of us were just taking financial advice from people who wore suspenders unironically. Then, by the early 2000s, the illusion was more or less complete. The McMansion suburbs popped up like mushrooms on a dead log. People were buying second SUVs to drive their to their second jobs, so their kids could go to a second tier college that they couldn't afford. I'd say it was the American dream as directed by David Lynch. It was bright and smiling, but it was quietly rotting underneath. So the sociologist Barbara Ehrenreich, in her book, Fear of Falling, she described it perfectly when she said that the middle class had internalized the terror of poverty so deeply that they'd do anything to avoid looking poor, even if that meant going broke trying to fake stability. Because being middle class wasn't really about having money. It was about maintaining the appearance of being respectable. And we all know how important it is to maintain appearances, right? Especially in the U.S. You could be drowning in debt, but as long as your lawn was manicured and your social media had vacation photos, you were fine. it's not a lifestyle. It's a performance. And credit was the stage lighting. Well, then 2008 happened. And in one spectacular implosion, the curtain fell. And so, people learned the hard way that the economy had been one giant Ponzi scheme with better packaging. And yet, when the whole thing collapsed, it wasn't the bankers who lost their homes. It was the baristas, the truck drivers, the retail workers, you know, the people who still believe the brochure. And the most convoluted part of this, we bailed out the banks that caused it all. And not because they were too big to fail, but because they were too big to admit it failed. And so, the cycle restarted. Only this time, we weren't even pretending the middle class was coming back. Now, the message was this. You're on your own, but here's an app to make it a little more fun. Isn't that nice? That's how we entered what I call the digital feudal age, where the lords have been replaced by tech CEOs and the castles by server farms. But the power dynamic was pretty much identical. So once again, a small handful of people own everything. And the rest of us rent just about everything, including our homes, our time, and now even our attention, because even our attention is an economy now. Okay. Somewhere between the end of World War II and the invention of the good old George Foreman grill, the U.S. managed to convince itself that everyone could have everything. You could be a plumber, own a home, own two cars and a summer boat. You didn't need a master's degree, just a union card, a back and knees that could still bend, and the ability to nod through your boss's lame small talk about the big game. This was the one brief shimmering moment when hard work actually did buy security. And not because the universe was suddenly fair, because the rest of the world was more or less in ruins. Europe started rebuilding, Japan was reconstructing, and the USA was the last man standing in a global bar fight. Manufacturing was booming, wages were high, and everyone was too traumatized from the war to question why all this prosperity felt vaguely temporary. And like every illusion, it needed an audience willing to believe. So, Piketty would later write that capitalism naturally tends to concentrate wealth, and that inequality isn't really a flaw, it's a feature. But for a few decades, the feature was hidden under a thick, glossy coat of optimism and cheap gas. The middle class wasn't proof that capitalism worked. It was proof that capitalism occasionally needed a public relations break. Because if you keep exploiting labor too visibly, people eventually stop showing up. And you can't run an economy if your workforce keeps dying in coal mines and debt spirals, right? I mean, you have to give them something, a reason to play along. So the system loosened its tie for a while, and it handed out mortgages and pensions, and of course the occasional paid vacation, and it gave you an identity, the American consumer. And what was that exactly? Well, you weren't poor, you were now middle class. You weren't alienated, you were aspirational. And you weren't overworked, you were providing. So in other words, congratulations. You're not oppressed, you're just part of a very enthusiastic waiting list for comfort. Now, Chris Hedges called this the cult of the self. A nation so desperate for the illusion of control that it began worshiping the idea of personal success as a moral achievement. If you weren't doing well, it wasn't because the deck was stacked. It was because you hadn't hustled hard enough. The American dream was no longer a collective promise. It was more like a Hunger Games application. That was the mentality. And so the middle class, this proud, caffeinated, mortgage-holding army, became both the symbol of progress and the mechanism that kept the whole show running. And they were the ones who bought the houses and financed the wars. They were the ones who believed the commercials. They were the buffer between the elite and the poor. The human firewall that absorbed the shock every time reality punched the economy in the face. And then came the automation, the offshoring, the deregulation, and one by one, the pillars that held up the illusion started to crumble. But nobody wanted to admit it, because, well, that would mean acknowledging that your parents' version of reality no longer existed. So what did we do? We just doubled down on the delusion. We traded pensions for 401ks and job security for flexibility. And we traded community for networking. Eventually, we took everything that made the illusion bearable and rebranded it for the gig economy. Because if you can't afford to live like a middle-class person, you can at least still think like one and try to look like one. Independent, entrepreneurial, and, well, perpetually one self-improvement book away from your big breakthrough. But, as Mark Fisher pointed out, corporate capitalism doesn't just sell products, it sells moods, emotion. The middle class wasn't about wealth so much as it was about vibes. It was the collective placebo effect, feeling stable. Well, it was, yeah, a feeling stable while the foundation quietly eroded underneath. And now, we're waking up from that dream. And like most dreams, it doesn't end. It just sort of fades away. And when it fades, you don't feel enlightened. You just feel kind of stupid. You feel like someone who bought into a timeshare in a sinking city. All right, now hold on, because it gets better. So, by the 1980s, the middle class was still smiling in all the brochures, but the photo was getting rather grainy and a little dog-eared. The factory jobs were disappearing, the pensions were dissolving, and the American dream was quietly being subcontracted to foreign shores. But instead of saying, hey, maybe this system doesn't really work anymore, we said, you know what'll fix this? Credit cards. That's right. And thus began the golden era of debt. That magical invention that let you take or let you live like your parents as long as you were okay with paying interest until you died. And debt became the new social contract. It was how you went to college, bought a car, bought a house, bought health care, had kids, and occasionally bought groceries when the other debts got too loud. And every time someone pointed out that the middle class was collapsing, a politician would suddenly appear on TV to assure us that everything was fine. As long as GDP was up and the Dow Jones was smiling like a Botoxed corpse. Meanwhile, regular people were out here maxing out 3 credit cards just to afford the so-called middle-class life, like extras trying to keep up with a collapsing set. So, Elizabeth Warren once called it the two-income trap. That's when families started needing both parents to work just to stay afloat, even though that second income used to be optional. Now, we didn't raise wages, we just added more workers to each household. You couldn't argue, or you could argue that this was all just a brilliant sleight of hand. We turned survival into feminism and burnout into empowerment. You can have it all, they said. Which turned out to mean you can work 60 hours a week and still feel guilty about the dishes. And while we were busy having it all, something subtle happened. The idea of the good job started to disappear, because the good jobs, they had benefits and stability, and it had a future. And the people at the top realized that stability was expensive. So they replaced it with opportunity, which sounds inspiring, of course. But then you realize opportunity is just corporate capitalism's polite word for you're on your own, sucker. So welcome to the era of flexibility. The cheerful corporate euphemism for never knowing how much you'll make next month, or next week for that matter. Also known as the gig economy or the side hustle. It's not exploitation, it's entrepreneurship. And, you know, you're not underpaid. You're building your brand, right? So we effectively turned serfdom into a subscription model. And instead of working for one lord, you now rent yourself out to dozens. Uber, DoorDash, Amazon. The algorithm that decides your worth per hour. And yet, we still cling to the fantasy. And we still think of ourselves as middle class. Even when we're one medical crisis away from homelessness. Because admitting that the dream died feels like a kind of blasphemy. Like admitting that your God stopped answering prayers because he got into real estate. Mark Fisher wrote that capitalism has reached the point where it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of this system. And that's because the system doesn't just own the money, it owns the imagination. It colonizes our sense of possibility. And it convinced us that any problem can be solved with a better app or a side hustle or, you know, a mindfulness subscription or something. And we used to ask, how do I make a living? And now we ask, how do I monetize existing? It's all become so absurd that it's not even tragic anymore. It's performance art. It's tragic comedy, really. We are a nation of people desperately pretending that the math still works. And we're a collapsing economy kept afloat by affirmations and caffeine. But you can only stretch an illusion so far before it snaps. And when it does, you don't just lose the lifestyle, you lose the whole mythology. And this is because the middle class wasn't just an economic category, it was a moral one. It was proof that you'd done things the right way, that you were responsible and disciplined. So when it dies, it doesn't just take away, or it doesn't just take your security, it takes your identity with it. And that's the part that no one really wants to talk about. And why doesn't anyone want to talk about it? Because when people lose their sense of identity, they don't become philosophical. They become angry. They cling to whatever ideology promises to restore meaning, even if it's built on nothing but delusion. Which brings us to where we are now, the post-illusion era, where everyone's screaming about politics because it's easier than admitting the economy has been looting us in broad daylight. Okay. Now, when the middle class started dying, it didn't go quietly. It went out like a drunk karaoke singer refusing to leave the stage. It was sweaty, nostalgic, and it was singing about better times that probably weren't that great to begin with, to be honest. Every dying empire has its soundtrack. Ours just happens to be the Beach Boys and Journey. Because when people lose stability, they reach for nostalgia. And America's favorite coping mechanism is pretending the 1950s were paradise. You know, that golden era when one income bought you a house and a car and a lifetime supply of mild emotional repression. Back when milkmen existed and racism was just part of the charm, and nobody heard the phrase student loan or credit card debt. And it's funny because people keep saying they want to make America great again, but they never specify for who. Because if you zoom out, the middle class wasn't actually built on equality. It was built on hierarchy. And it worked because certain people were kept out. So now, everyone's trying to resurrect a ghost that never really existed. The dream of universal comfort in a system that runs on scarcity. But nostalgia nostalgia sells better than nuance. And it's why, it's why political movements have replaced religion. They offer the same thing, identity and meaning, the comforting belief that someone else is responsible for why your life fell apart. And rage is easier than grief. Rage gives you something to do with your hands while you're watching the dream collapse before your eyes. So people lash out at immigrants, trans, gays, women, at each other, anyone who can temporarily fill in for the real culprit, the plutocrats, and the corrupt economic system itself. Now, Chris Hedges once wrote that societies in decline become obsessed with spectacle because they've lost faith in substance. And here we are, living proof, scrolling through outrage like it's oxygen and mistaking the performance of anger for the pursuit of change. Because what's left when the illusion breaks? You can't build meaning and credit anymore. You can't pay for identity with an APR. So the market invented something new to sell you. Hopium. Not real hope. Not the kind that actually changes anything. Just aspirational content. You can't afford a house? Oh, no problem. Here's a podcast about how to manifest abundance. Oh, you're drowning in debt? Oh, don't worry. This influencer made it out by waking up at 4 a.m. and drinking mushroom coffee. Are you feeling lost and alienated? Well, there's a $1,200 seminar on finding your purpose. So what we've done is we've turned the collapse of the middle class into a multi-billion dollar self-help industry. Because if you can't fix a system, well, the next best thing is to make people believe it's their fault. And meanwhile, the actual elites, the real ones, not the ones your uncle yells about, are quietly turning the world back into a digital feudal state, now known as techno-feudalism. And they own the platforms, the property, they own the data, and now the debt. We don't own things anymore. We rent or subscribe to them. We rent homes, music, cars, movies, software, even our social lives. We're not citizens. We're just subscribers. And like good little subscribers, we've accepted that we don't need ownership, just access. So you don't have to own land. You just rent a slice of the cloud and you call that freedom. Now, back in medieval times, you paid a portion of your harvest to your lord. Now, you pay a portion of your paycheck to 47 different companies that all auto-renew monthly. So you're not a serf. You're a premium member. Mark Fisher once said that capitalism's greatest trick is making people believe that there's no alternative, that this is just how life works. And he was right. I mean, we're not fighting the system anymore. We're just trying to get better Wi-Fi inside of it, because better Wi-Fi means a better fix for our collective dopamine addiction. But here's what I would call the darkly funny part. The collapse might actually be liberation. Because once you realize the dream was never really yours, you can finally stop trying to save it. And I think that's the quiet secret under all the noise. When you stop pretending you're a temporarily embarrassed millionaire, as John Steinbeck put it, you start to see the absurdity of the game. And absurdity, in a way, is freedom. At some point, you stop trying to fix the dream and you just start sweeping up the confetti. And I think that's the real moment of clarity. When we realize that the collapse isn't coming because it's already here. And we just keep expecting it to look dramatic or cinematic. You know, mushroom clouds, burning cities, Bruce Willis in a tank top. But real collapse is rather muted. It's the sound of your health insurance premium going up and your landlord raising rent because the market. It's the creeping realization that adulthood is now just a long-term survival game with better lighting. And yet, buried in all this absurdity, there's a strange, reluctant kind of freedom. Because once you stop believing the system was designed for you. You stop taking it personally when it fails. And you stop asking, what the hell is wrong with me? And you start asking, who the hell built all this nonsense? You stop mistaking exhaustion for ambition. And you stop chasing a lifestyle that was marketed to you like a cult recruitment ad with a mortgage. And you finally begin to see that what we call success is usually just the ability to endure a system that's slowly killing you with a smile. And when you finally let that illusion go, something weird happens. You start to feel lighter. Because the truth is, the middle class was never about wealth. It was about belonging. And maybe belonging was the illusion all along. You don't belong to an economy. You never did. You belong to the people you love and the things you make and the experiences that make you feel briefly unbroken. And when you realize that, life becomes less of a race and more of a scavenger hunt. You start noticing small things like a quiet morning, a cheap beer, a friend who still answers your calls even when you don't have anything interesting to say. It's not glamorous. And it's not going to trend, but it's real. And maybe that's the only kind of wealth left that can't be repossessed. So Chris Hedges said, hope is not about the right outcome. It's about the right to keep fighting. And I think that what he meant is that hope doesn't have to be pretty. It doesn't have to come with benefits or dental. Hope can just be the decision to stay human in a system that keeps trying to automate your soul. So I think maybe what this means is that the liberation isn't a revolution. It's more of just a quiet refusal. Refusing to measure your worth by productivity. And refusing to turn your exhaustion into some vapid brand. It's just saying no to buying into the same illusion just because it comes in a new color. Maybe liberation is just learning to live like the empire already fell, because from a certain perspective, it did. And here we are. We're still laughing and eating and still finding meaning in the ruins. And I think that's the funny thing about collapse. It's never total. There's always something left, usually something small and stubborn and kind of surprisingly beautiful hidden in the aftermath. Though, you got to dig around a little to find it. Like, I don't know, the way grass grows through the cracks in the concrete, or how some folks still sing at funerals. or I don't know, however, how after everything, we're still here talking and thinking and making jokes about the apocalypse because humor is the last luxury the system can't privatize. So no, the middle class isn't coming back. But I think that's okay, actually. Because I don't think we need an illusion of stability to be alive. I think we just need enough clarity to laugh at the absurdity of everything and just, well, and just enough decency to keep each other warm while the world cools down. Because if the middle class was a mirage, then maybe what comes after isn't a desert. Maybe it's a clearing. All right. I think that's all I've got today. Thanks so much for listening.